This place is out of sight, isn't it? I mean, literally. Well, this is, I guess, the way the courtroom was in some respects. You always have a feeling that Judge Hoffman is kind of like the lights up there. It's good to be here. Took a while, I think. But the first thing I'd like to say is thank you, because I think it was the people out there in the audience, people in Santa Barbara, people in Berkeley, that got us out of jail. It had nothing to do with the appeals courts. It was the people who did it. That what happened during the trial was we demonstrated one thing I think that's crucial. And that is that, and Richard Nixon understands it, certainly Spiro Agnew understands it, that the most incendiary idea that we have ever had is all power to the people. And that the people of the country basically freed us. People always talk about the appeals courts and why don't you wait till you get to the appeals courts? Don't disrupt. Well, my generation hasn't been used to waiting, because we've seen past generations who have waited and they get to be 50 years old or 60 years old and they have very little. They have a house maybe, some cars, but they have very little in terms of their own humanity. And so when lawyers tell us that we should wait for the appeals courts, we said that was wrong. Because this is a time that really requires angry men to stand up and not to wait for some appeals court like that, which is going to have Carswell and Berger on it. So we felt that we had to fight directly. That if the slogan of the 60s of freedom now is meaningful, so must be the slogan of justice now. So we were contemptuous in the courtroom. All of you would have been, because you're human, and human beings have to fight. That's the one thing we learned about Chicago in 68, and the same thing we learned in the courtroom in Chicago in 1969. And that is that we should no longer see ourselves as brutalized people, as martyrs, as victims. We should develop a kind of way of thinking where we see ourselves as winning, and winning by fighting. And I think that's what really characterized this trial. People said that we had courage, but our courage was derived from the people around the country who gave us their support. And we weren't eight unique men. We were, in fact, like everybody else. We just happened to be the scapegoats at the time. But I think that the fact that we did fight is proof of the fact that it's important to, because we did win. And I think that's what's going to happen in the 70s. You see, in the 60s, and it's interesting that this trial ended on February of 1970, because in February of 1960, six SNCC workers sat in Greensboro, North Carolina, and began what was the beginning of a movement that's grown 10 years since that time. And it's grown not simply in terms of numbers, it's grown in terms of ideas. That what comes out of the 60s really is an emergent vision of a new society, and a real sense of one's culture. That we begin to understand that we have a culture, that we are real, that in fact we are revolutionaries. Now, we didn't start out the 60s by being revolutionaries. We started out the 60s by going to the South as liberals. We went there with the idea that if you can organize enough black people and register them to vote, that the Johnson administration or the Kennedy administration or whichever will hear that sound and will deal with racism in America. We were very naive in 1960. We found out about America not through a sense of having read it in books. We found it out in the streets. And I think that's what's finally became what was on trial in Chicago. In fact, they told us the same. That what was on trial in Chicago was that generation of people, that movement that we've created. Maybe not so much the past 10 years, because the past 10 years are over, but what was really on trial in Chicago is the next 10 years. The next 10 years. And if we describe the 60s as the period of the sit-in, we can describe the 70s as the period of the trial. That in the 1970s, we're going to have to deal with the trial that's going to be brought against us in terms of oppression, in terms of the environment, in terms of the war, in terms of racism. And that one thing is very clear. Everybody always talks about provocation. Well, our existence basically provoked them in Chicago. We could have sat silent in that courtroom every day, and we would have provoked them. Because by our being alive, by our being fresh, by our being free, we provoked them. At Michigan the other day, I saw it happen very clearly. There was a demonstration. There was no violence. And all of a sudden, just because they were demonstrating, they brought in the police and club demonstrators. People responded by throwing bricks. It was good. But we did not provoke it. They provoked it. Now I want to talk a bit about the trial, because I think it's symbolic. Because much of what happened in the streets of Chicago happened in the courtroom. And let me just describe a bit about that courtroom, since most of you have never come to it. Let's assume you wanted to go to the trial, you know, all of you. And you would come to the federal building, and you'd be met by six marshals. And they'd say, you can't come in. You'd say, why not? And they'd say, because you're young, because you have long hair, because you wear a miniskirt, because a miniskirt, you know, in Chicago is about that far above the ankle. But any place, let's assume you then come in as my brother, or as my cousin, or as my aunt or uncle. You see, to be tried for conspiracy means one has to understand it. We never have actually understood the indictments. Abby Hoffman summed it up best. I'm not going to deal with the law in this talk, because that's not my province. But Abby said the best thing I think that could be said about what we were tried for, he said that he couldn't understand the indictment because he's never been tried for his dreams before. That he didn't understand what it means to be tried for your dreams. So in effect, we never understood what we were being tried for, except I think it had to do with something about our youth and something about those dreams and what those dreams may mean. But anyway, to conspire means to breathe together. And we all breathe together. We're all brothers and sisters. So we would take everybody in as our relatives. I brought about 4,000 cousins into the trial. Then you go up to the 23rd floor where the courtroom was, and you're met by another half a dozen marshals. And they'd say, oh, here comes Freund with another cousin again. And then you'd be searched. You'd be searched. They'd take away your pencils, your papers, your newspapers, your magazines, your lipsticks, your nail files. Take everything away. It might be a weapon, you see. One of the women might try and rip off Judge Hoffman with a lipstick or something. So then you go into the courtroom, and most of the people who are here would be thrown out because you're slouching slightly. If you smiled, you'd be thrown out. If you laughed, you could be arrested. During the trial, three newsmen were arrested. The jury was sequestered. The defendants were already indicted. The lawyers have since been indicted. The spectators were arrested. The only people who got off were Hoffman and the prosecutor. Well, one day, for example, Susan Hathaway, who is one of our staff, after one of Judge Hoffman's brilliant rulings, of which there were many, his rulings were basically defined, if they were brilliant, it was because it was against us. But in any case, after one of his rulings, she went, my God, that much, and she was thrown out. There was basically a police state. There were 20 to 30 marshals in the courtroom at all times, and they always were watching us, watching the spectators and what have you. Then there was the jury in this neon oven, as Abby calls it. The jury never moved throughout the entire trial. There was one alternate lady we call the dead lady. But you all remember that there was a compromise verdict. And I want to talk about that because I think it's important to differentiate certain people in America. We didn't want a compromise verdict. We wanted to have a hung jury. We wanted a hung jury for two reasons. One, it would have been a great victory if everybody had gotten off. Although it is true that even though Lee Weiner and I were acquitted, we believe that nobody has been acquitted. You're still on trial. I'm still on trial. The five are still on trial. And nobody's acquitted until the five are completely free. And certainly nobody's acquitted until Bobby Seale is back in the streets again. So it would have been a victory, a bigger victory. It was already a victory if we had a hung jury. But well, they might have retried us. They might have retried us. We thought that would be good because then the seven of us would have defended ourselves. And if they thought this trial was kind of weird, they ought to see what's going to happen when the seven of us defend ourselves. We've offered Bill and Lenny our services when they come up if they have to have a trial for their contempt citations. In any case, there's one thing that's very true about America, and that is that we're a melting pot nation. People come from Africa, they came as slaves. People come from Europe, people came from Asia. And we come to America as a kind of gigantic melting pot. When you get here, you all become the same again. I mean, all those differences are lost. You become the same people with the same houses, the same lifestyle, what have you. And I think that there's one thing that's very important about that. The way that the system holds itself together around that melting pot is by saying that the primary political thing that men have to do is to compromise. Well, my generation, the movement that I arise from, says that the most important thing that men can do is honor the differences in men, not try and take them away. That we don't believe in compromise. We don't believe in compromise because we think it's a time when men have to stand up and fight, when angry men have to show that they're angry. So we don't want compromise. We want strong people to take strong stands. And that jury did not take a strong stand. That jury negotiated and compromised. And in fact, one juror said that they didn't want to have a hung jury because the government had spent so much money on the trial. Sometimes one gets the belief that America is dehumanized. You see it all the time. Lawyers say that they're glad that people were acquitted of the conspiracy charge. They're glad that Lee and I were acquitted of the making bombs charge. It's good that the five were convicted of intent to incite a riot or whatever that thing was, because now the higher courts can test it. Now the higher courts can test whether this law is constitutional or not. And that's the way people perceive it. Not what happened to the five men, but we can test the law. That's horseshit as far as I'm concerned. But there's one thing about the So there was a jury. So they compromised. We reached four people, though. We reached them by being ourselves, by not wearing white shirts and ties, by not cutting our hair short. I mean, could you imagine Abby Hoffman cutting his hair short and wearing a white shirt and tie? This is a jury. They compromised. Then there was a prosecution, Ferran and Schultz. You know about Ferran. He's the one that said we were evil, said we were fags, said we were part of the freaking fag revolution who was trying to take away America's children. Well, you know what happened about that? I gave a speech in Colorado a couple weeks ago, and they were so afraid about security that they had police all around. And throughout the whole damn speech, there was a man behind the curtain with a I hope he's for me because I'm in a very vulnerable position right here. Okay, then, anyway, we were the fags, right? The freaking fag revolution. The reason Ferran said that is because he tried to proposition Jerry Rubin all throughout the trial. And Jerry turned him down. And then there was Schultz. Schultz was a, talk about a generational trial or a cultural trial. Schultz wore a gray suit, a white shirt, and a gray tie every day of the trial. I mean, he was unbelievable. He got a haircut 2 times a week. Then there was the judge. Everybody's heard about Judge Hoffman. He's 5'4". He wears 8-foot robes. His last trial was the Spanish Inquisition. And, you know, he was a bigger ham than the defendants were in certain ways. But I don't want to say a lot about him. Enough has been said about him already. Except to say that this wasn't a unique case for him. He's been doing this to people all along. And that we have to understand that it's not Judge Hoffman as an isolated character. And it's not necessarily the laws that are wrong. Judge Hoffman is a political appointee. Judges are political appointees. Therefore, they come out of the same political system that puts up people like Nixon and Agnew into the White House. I mean, the whole thing's rotten at core. But he's also no joke at all, because he has the power to put us away. He had the power to bind and gag Bobby Seale. He had the power to give the lawyers 4 years for contempt. He had the power to do all that. And he's going to probably do more in future cases. And so he's no joke and should not be taken as a joke. But he should not be taken as an isolated character either. He's much more important than that. He's a man who has a lifetime tenure. Lifetime tenure. That's, you know, like faculty members have on universities. You can't get rid of them either. In any case, so I don't want to say more about the jury. Or rather the judge. I want to talk about our table and about our liberated zone. See, the government had a theory that says we couldn't give the yippies permits to have a festival of life in Lincoln Park because they would turn into a liberated zone. And they said that Abbie Hoffman had written papers saying that there was going to be public fornication, dope smoking, draft resistance meetings, karate, people were going to swim in the lake. All that good kind of stuff. And anyway, Abbie never said that stuff because you know that Abbie has never said fornication in his life. So we decided to have a liberated zone. If they wouldn't let us have a liberated zone in Lincoln Park, or we were going to liberate the courtroom. And we did, to a certain degree. Our table was covered with jelly beans and newspapers, underground newspapers, magazines. It had everything on it. Lee Weiner had his feet up on the table all the time reading a book. And it was a very interesting table. And I want to tell you one anecdote, because I'm speaking with Bill, and I think it's a characteristic of the table, but also I shouldn't say that. You could get letters. You could write his letters. One day there was a letter sent to us that said, Abbie Hoffman, Kara Magoo's courtroom, Chicago, Illinois. It was delivered. Then one day there was a letter came. It was a little thicker, and Abbie wasn't paying any attention. And he ripped it open and out poured this green stuff all over the table. We didn't know what to do. What do you do with a federal courtroom, the highest courtroom in the land, with a table covered with dope? So we gathered it all up. We gathered it all up, put a piece of paper over it, and let it sit there all day. And there, I'll tell you one thing, there was no contempt that day at all. So at the end of the day, we realized that we had to get rid of this stuff in one way or another because we didn't want to leave it there. I mean, we didn't want them to have it. So that when the jury went out, the jury went out, Bill got up and said, Your Honor, Abbie Hoffman was delivered a letter today that contains some green plant-like material. And the prosecutor jumped up and said, I'll bet it's marijuana. And Bill said, well, it does have a rather sweetish odor to it. See, he's trying to be different. He didn't want to let you know how he knew how it smelled. So Judge Hoffman leaned over. We expected some kind of thunderbolt to come down. And he said, Mr. Kunstler, you're a very accomplished lawyer, and I'm sure that you can dispose of them. And so Bill said, rising up, Your Honor, I will take that material and I will dispose of it personally tonight. I just want to say that we never did see it again. I think that kind of characterizes our table. That characterizes the liberated zone. That not only did we not wear shirts and ties in the courtroom, but we didn't hide anything in so many ways. And I think that's a meaningful statement. The most meaningful statement that can really be said about the trial is that nobody held back in any kind of way in many respects. But it was a trial, and there was evidence. There was evidence. I'd like to run down the government's evidence, you know. Like, I was charged with teaching and demonstrating the use of an incendiary device to blow up the underground garage in Grant Park. Now, I bet you can't guess how I was going to blow up that underground garage. With a Molotov cocktail. It was a little fantasy associated with it, but we didn't try and rebut that evidence. Then there was, people were convicted of giving 12 speeches. And let me run through these speeches since they're very interesting. Dave Dellinger gave 2 speeches, one in San Diego. In San Diego, an FBI informer heard him. During the case, the government put on about 90 witnesses. They put on men who were FBI informers, FBI agents, policemen, police undercover agents. They had a person from Army intelligence, and they even had somebody from Navy intelligence there, went on the stand. They had people from the mayor's office. They had people for work for the city. They had 2 people. They had a barmaid and a young kid. The young kid was their last witness, sort of like to dispel our images as being young people. And so that it was very interesting to see policemen, one right after another, going on the stand. But only the police brass wore their uniforms, only the higher-ups. In fact, we heard, Bill got this out on cross-examination, that Ferran had told the regular policemen not to wear the uniforms, because he didn't want to get the jury to have the impression that these were policemen after policemen after policemen. So they put 2 people on, 2 people on. We began to think after a while that there were 8,000 undercover agents in Chicago and 8 demonstrators. There was one demonstrator, one FBI informer who used to meet his FBI contact on a Little League ball field. I mean, the whole thing was right out of Mission Impossible or something. In any case, Dave Dellinger's speech in San Diego talked about the war in Vietnam, finished up the speech by saying, see you in Chicago. That's evidence. That's it there. The second speech Dave gave, he said to cool it. Sit down, cool it, sit down, cool it. 5 hours later, violence breaks out in front of the Hilton Hotel. That's Dave's inciting to riot speech. It's a little slow, but that's got him. Those 2 things convicted him for 5 years. That's all the evidence against Dave Dellinger. Then there was a speech that Rennie Davis gave at Case Western Reserve University. We saw a film of that, quite a few films in the trial. That speech showed Rennie talking as I am now. That speech was so liberal, so wishy-washy, so nonviolent, that when it was over, Rennie turned to us and apologized. Then there was the evidence against Jerry Rubin. Jerry Rubin threw a sweater at a policeman. It hit him. Cross-examination, Bill said, did it hurt? Policeman said no. Then, second evidence against Jerry is he flicked a cigarette at a policeman and missed. But then Jerry was very obscene. And the police always testified about his saying obscenities. And it would go like this. A 250-pound Chicago policeman would go on the stand, sit down, say his name, so on and so forth. And they'd say, what did Jerry Rubin say? And he'd say, well, Jerry Rubin said tonight during a speech, we're going to stay in the obscenity park. And so Ferran would say, well, tell us what the obscenity was. Chicago policeman would say, I don't use that kind of language. So Leonard Weinglass at this point got up and said, are our clients being prosecuted for their obscenities? Judge Hoffman said, yes. And at this point, all defense were saying, go ahead, let him say it. Go ahead. And then so we'd say, okay, so everybody be waiting silently. And Judge Hoffman would lean over and say, go ahead, say it. What was it? So a guy would say his four-letter word. Say, Jerry Rubin said, MFer. M-F-E-R. It's a four-letter word. Obscene, I don't know. But that was the sort of thing. A lot of fucking was used. You know, we're going to stay in a fucking park. I never heard so much obscenity in my life out of the government's witnesses. It was really quite interesting. Jock Levy, who was a producer of Old Calcutta, testified. Cross-examination, did they ask him about the facts that he had testified to? No, they said, Mr. Levy, how many nude people are on the stage in Old Calcutta at any one time? That was the cross-examination of Jock Levy. Cross-examination of Allen Ginsberg, who, by the way, is one of our greatest witnesses. You ought to have seen... You ought to have seen Judge Hoffman when Allen started to ohm. He never could quite deal with that one. So how do they cross-examine Allen Ginsberg? They bring in a book, all his books of his poetry. They ask him to read his poetry and then try and demonstrate that he's an evil homosexual man, that his writing is obscene. That's a kind of cross-examination. So they call, it's always the same thing. It's like what happens in Vietnam, it happens everywhere. The government calls the victims the guilty parties. So it seems to me the government is trying to show we're obscene. Well, I think it's just the reverse. And I think it was clearly demonstrated. All right. So then there was the evidence against Tom Hayden. Let the out of a police car tire. And they weren't even sure he did it. It may have been Wolf Lowenthal. But Wolf Lowenthal was an unindicted co-conspirator, so Tom was responsible for his act. And also Tom gave a speech that said to the people in the Hilton Hotel, open your doors and let us come in and wash and take showers and eat breakfast. And that was good for 5 years. The government had a very interesting theory about the Hilton Hotel. They said that Lee Weiner and I decided it was too dangerous to march to the amphitheater because there might be counter-demonstrators. And so we decided to have another safer plan. The safer plan that Lee and I came up with was taking the 15th floor of the Hilton Hotel. With 15,000 demonstrators, you know, they sort of come in, they take the elevator and go up and take it over. So that I think it's, evidence. Abbie Hoffman. Abbie Hoffman was guilty of kidnapping and extortion. Extortion says to the deputy mayor of Chicago, if you give the yuppies $100,000, we'll leave town. The second, Abbie was incensed at that. He wouldn't have taken less than $200,000. Then there was the kidnapping charge. Abbie was supposed to have said that we're going to kidnap the Big Cheese and take him to the amphitheater. Big Cheese was the deputy commander of the Chicago Police Force. We were just going to sort of wrap him up and have him walk along with us. And the policeman actually, I think, was surrounded by policemen at that point, the deputy commander. But anyway, that's Abbie's charges. Lee Weiner, there was so little evidence against him that I think the jury still thinks he's part of our legal staff. And then there's me. I mean, I'm left. This is a historic trial. You all understand that. It's very difficult to go down in history as the mastermind of the great stink bomb plot. But It does. I mean, at least the other guys were convicted for giving speeches. I'm stuck with the old butyric acid. And I don't know if you've read Mike Royko's column on it, but if you haven't, I'll tell you the evidence. This is how it goes. Government, I have a PhD in chemistry. You know how to make a stink bomb. I actually could tell you how, because I didn't cross a state line to get here. But anyway, I don't know what the state charges on that are like. But in any case, I have this PhD in chemistry and I do know how to make one, but the government's testimony is that I didn't know how to do it. But I remember that when I was 6 years old, my mother had used a very smelly hair remover. So I thought, aha, I get a few gallons of this stinky hair remover, I can stink bomb all of Chicago with it. But I can't remember what it was, so I go to Walgreens drugstore on State Street, and I walk up to a lady attendant and say, "Madam, I'd like to buy some hair remover." She says, "Fine." I say, "Do you mind if I smell some?" For half an hour, I stand there smelling ladies' hair removers. She becomes suspicious. Why would a grown man? So that I decide to flee the scene. And I do, escape, not arrested. And I get out of there. And then I think, aha, butyric acid. So we get the butyric acid. I buy the butyric acid, giving my name. Very intelligent thing to do as a good revolutionary, supposedly. And then I give it, but I'm a male chauvinist, and so I think that I have to dupe three women, and I dupe three women, and they take the stuff and pour it on handkerchiefs and take it to a burlesque bar in the Palmer House called a Cafe Agogo and drop these handkerchiefs and stinks up the bar, and they're arrested, and that's my intent to incite a riot as the mastermind of that plot. We didn't try and rebut that on our defense. In fact, to be serious, we didn't rebut a lot of that kind of testimony. We didn't feel it was necessary. We didn't feel that the issues that we wanted to deal with required that we should also rebut that kind of garbage. So that, in fact, we didn't do that. In fact, the government wouldn't let us have a Festival of Life in Lincoln Park, so we brought it into the courtroom. We put on the Festival of Life in the courtroom. We brought in Judy Collins, we brought in Pete Seeger, we brought in Arlo Guthrie. Arlo Guthrie was out of sight. He did Alice's Restaurant, recited the whole thing. Judge Hoffman forgot that he was reciting a song, or if he ever knew it, maybe. I'm not even sure he knew it. And when evidently Arlo in the song is reciting the part about where you go to the draft board and have the psychiatric test, Judge Hoffman leaned over and said, "Excuse me, but did you get off?" He never. So we brought on Arlo Guthrie. Dustin Hoffman came and sat in our staff section. It was pretty interesting because Dustin Hoffman was introduced to the U.S. prosecutor by Jerry Rubin. Prosecutors wanted to meet Dustin Hoffman, so they asked us to introduce him to him. And so on and so forth. We brought on talked about the war in Vietnam, Peter Martinson, who had been involved in atrocities in Vietnam. Bobby Seale came back. Bobby Seale never left, in fact. Julian Bond came. Dick Gregory came. Jesse Jackson came. How the government dealt with this, you see, is to say that even though we brought 100 people, we didn't bring on policemen after police, and we brought on people of all walks of life. We brought on a revolutionary, Linda Morris. We brought on Dick Goodwin, who was Kennedy's speechwriter. We wanted to bring on Ramsey Clark, but his testimony was declared irrelevant and immaterial by the judge. Ramsey Clark was a little angry at that. He felt that it was sort of silly for him, who had been the attorney general, to be told by an assistant U.S. prosecutor that his testimony was irrelevant. So we brought on everybody. We brought on people who could hurt us, people who could help us. We weren't afraid of that. We wanted to put before that jury what we were about. And we did so, I think. The fact we did win 4 jurors. Those jurors were middle America. They weren't our peers. They weren't our peers at all. They were middle America. And we reached 4 of them. We proved that we could put ourselves out front as we were and still win people. We didn't have to cut our hair and hide behind some kind of veneer. We actually proved what we were about. We attempted to demonstrate what we were about. Now, we almost didn't get all our evidence in. It was kind of like everything that was good for us was irrelevant. Everything that was bad for us was right on. So the Judge Hoffman helped out. Judge Hoffman would stop the proceedings and say to the prosecutor, "Don't you want to object to that question?" Fran would say, "Okay, I'll object. I sustain." I don't want to go on much longer. What I want to do was, in my part of this thing, is to kind of describe a scenario, the what actually went on in the courtroom to some extent. And Bill will take off on a different tact. I think that the one thing I do want to say is that the most important thing that happened in the trial was Bobby Seale. And the most important thing that we have to do right now is to defend Bobby Seale in Connecticut. See, they never could bind and gag him effectively, because even when he was gagged, he still spoke out in the courtroom and said, "I want to defend myself. I have a constitutional right to defend myself." And the last day before he was taken away, they realized that even that wasn't working. So they got a ball of gauze that big, and they tried to, they said, "Bobby, we're going to put this in your mouth, then we're going to wrap you up." Bobby said, "Oh, no, you're not." And they said, "Yes, we are." So they pinched his nose off so he couldn't breathe, held the gauze up to his mouth so when he opened it, they'd stick it in. But when he ran out of breath. And he fought and fought until they had to let him free. So the next time they tried it, they used four U.S. Marshals. One held his head this way, one held his head this way, one pinched his nose off, and one tried was going to put the gauze in. No matter how hard they tried, they could not get the gauze in his mouth. And I think that speaks to the most important thing that Bobby proved, and that is no matter how hard the U.S. government tries, they couldn't bind and gag Bobby Seale. No matter how... And no matter how hard they try, they can't stop the black liberation struggle in this country. But we have to understand, I think, that we have to understand that this thing isn't over. That, in fact, the 70s, as I said earlier, is going to be a period of trial. There, Nixon and Hoffman and Agnew and Mitchell, they're kind of like dinosaurs in a sense. They're like dinosaurs because they're rapidly becoming extinct. But they're going to breathe fire, and they're going to attempt to deal with us because they understand one very important thing, that finally youth must will out. Carl Oglesby, during the trial, said something that was very important. He said that in Chicago, a new order was being born. The future was being created there. But the past is never ready for the future. The past is never ready to peacefully yield to the future. The future always arrives, he said, kicking and screaming like a baby being born. And he said that in Chicago, there were undertakers in the delivery room. And I think that's true, that we're the children, we're the babies that they want to destroy. They say we're violent. Birth of a baby is a violent act. It's bloody, but you don't see the blood, you see the baby, unless you're a sick person or a sick society. And I think that what happened in Chicago was that maybe a new future wasn't being created, but I think that the future was on trial. The future was on trial. And that I think, though, it still is true that that we can't lose because we are the babies. We are that new generation. And I think that, as I said earlier, the most important, the most incendiary idea that we've understood, or we understand now, is that of the phrase, "All power to the people." And I think in the next 10 years during the trial, I think the most relevant thing we can do is make that phrase meaningful, that phrase relevant. All power to the people. Thank you.
What can one person say about the next gentleman to speak? He's probably the best-known advocate in America today. He has fought the growing repression in this country, whether it be in a racist town in the South or in a just as racist town in the North, on our university campus, or in a courtroom in Chicago. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. William Kunstler.
Thank you very, very much. I'm, at long last, happy to be here. I understand that in the decision to defer me, that Mr. Ray Page indicated that I should speak nowhere in the United States. And I understand this is the superintendent of public instruction for the entire state. I hope that his career as a basketball coach was more successful. Now, he apparently was joined in the two-man minority by Timothy Swain. See, I don't know the local pronunciation that well. But apparently, this gentleman indicated that I had said somewhere that violence was as American as cherry pie. I would like to take credit for that, but it came from a client of mine named H. Rapp Brown. And I don't think it should have been any obstacle for him if he were invited to speak here. As far as the second accusation, I was termed a cop killer, I think, by Mr. Swain, or Swine, as you will, on the grounds of a speech I gave in Oakland, California, last July, in which I stated the use of self-defense in Plainfield, New Jersey, collective self-defense, which had resulted in the stomping to death of a policeman who had shot a young black man through the stomach twice in an unprovoked attack. And I did discuss the law of collective self-defense. I guess if, according to him, that makes me a cop killer, I'll have to live with that. But I think if he would read the entire speech, he would find it had more basis than malice on my part. I am very happy that the board reversed itself. I think it would have been a profound disgrace, had they not. And that I'm here today, I think, is due to the essential courage and integrity of the students, who I think, like the people John mentioned, because of course you are the people, realizing that you have the power of being right and being young and having the blood course through your veins at a rate of speed that may make men like Timothy Swain and Ray Page wonder where the world's going. But the students forced me to be here. I am not here because of any Board of Trustees. I'm here because the Board of Trustees read the tea leaves correctly the second time around. I do want to thank men like Howard Clement and Ted Jones, who did stand up from the beginning as to my right to be here. Now, just before I begin, I want to let you know, because I let the press know today, that I had received a telegram from George T. Frampton, the Vice Chancellor for Campus Affairs, indicating that the president of this university and his wife had received two personal telephone calls of anonymous threats upon my life. And then the telegram states specifically, the callers stated that if you came here, you would not leave alive. Now, the thing that bothers me the most about this is not that threats were made, but that the university could not afford more than a night letter to let me know. I told the people in Chicago, when they asked me whether this would make me refuse to come or worry about coming, and I told them, of course it makes me worry about coming. I think that we've had so much death and destruction, if they want to talk about violence, heaped upon the movement in this country, that I knew that any madman could attempt to see that I did not leave here alive. And I think this is a possibility with anyone who finds himself in the position I'm in, or the position John's in, or any of the other people in this country, and there are many more than us, of course, who are out front for things that they believe in or are working for. I, of course, am worried. I'd be less than human if I didn't say that to you. But I was goddamned if I was not going to come because some lunatic made a telephone call and tried to indicate that if I did come, I would not get out of here alive. I think the right of free speech on my part is of some importance to me, but more important than that is the right that you have, which is under the same First Amendment, to listen to whom you please. Now, I want to talk about the trial in a little different way than John did. John gave you some of the anecdotal background, and as he described it, I was laughing over remembering many of the incidents which he remembered. I want to correct one thing. I did not tell Judge Hoffman that that interestingly smelling substance that John referred to would be disposed of that night. My words, as I recall them, were, Judge, I'll see that it's burnt tonight. But the trial had many comical moments, many pathetic moments, many tragic moments, many sublime moments. It was a real time to be alive and to be in that courtroom. And there was no minute of those 5 long months that I felt that I was not privileged and honored to be sitting in our liberated zone. That zone was symbolically very important to us. It was a zone which John has adequately described, but it must be contrasted with the zone across the corridor in the courtroom, because the prosecution zone was a slave zone. It was a zone peopled by 4 men, and these very 4 men symbolized the difference between our table and their table and our world and their world. The U.S. attorney and the assistant U.S. attorney were dressed as John indicated. Haircuts biweekly, dark suits, white shirts, and always an attitude of the bent knee and the bowed head in front of His Awesome Majesty on the bench. No king ever received more humble servants than did Julius I on the bench. But John didn't tell you there were 2 other gentlemen at that table. One of them was a young man by the name of Roger Cubbage. Now, if you can conjure up in your mind what a young man in government service by the name of Roger Cubbage would look like, I think you'll have little difficulty in drawing him. Glasses, close-cropped hair, dark suits, the expression which we used to call shit eating when I was in college, but which I guess for more polite audiences would be that of having just swallowed the canary in the back room. Roger Cubbage's function was to run the projector and to interrogate several of the cameraman witnesses who introduced the films they put in to show how subversive the eight were. And the first time he was pressed into service in the third week of the trial, the lights dimmed, the screen was in place, the camera was threaded with the film. Mr. Foran said, "All right, Roger." Roger pulled the switch, and the film was off the sprockets. Jerry Rubin in Sotto Voce said, "You blew it, Roger." And that's essentially what the government did. They blew it. The fourth member of their table was Joseph Stanley. You probably never heard of Joseph Stanley, but he is known well to his employer, J. Edgar. He was the FBI agent whose sole function, after he took over the camera duties from poor old Cubbage, was to sneak out of the courtroom when each one of our witnesses took the stand, be gone 2 or 3 minutes. We first attributed this to a weak bladder, but then discovered he would come back silently into the courtroom with a little manila folder. And this was the dossier that Mr. Hoover that was a true Freudian slip that Mr. Hoover had prepared on each witness. And we would watch each time as if we were at Forest Hills watching a tennis game or watching a ping pong match. We would watch for the exit and entrance of Herr Stanley. And he would pass this folder to whichever one of the two short hairs who were assigned to the cross-examination of our witnesses. And they would read through it with the frenzied expression of men looking for the choice tidbit about the particular witness so that they could bring the government's case home safe into harbor with the fact that Allen Ginsberg believed in homosexual love, or that another witness had said out in California, "I train with an M1 rifle and I am taking lessons in karate." And then these things were roared back with the question, "And is it true, Miss Morse, that you train with an M1 in California?" She said, "Why, yes, that appears in my Playboy interview." The difference in the tables, I think, is very symbolic, was very interesting, and we began to note it constantly as the trial wore on. And our liberated zone was a true liberated zone. The judge tried to restrict it somewhat and thus ushered in what came to be known in history as the great bathroom debate. The judge, finally seeing that very few defendants were hanging around the courtroom during the trial, but were out in the corridor with their newsman friends, or making calls, or talking to witnesses, or upon rare occasions going to the men's room, said that there were to be no further trips out of the courtroom during the trial. And they were to relieve themselves, not too frequently, he hoped, in the holding cell that is next to the courtroom, the place they hold the prisoners when they bring them in from the lockup. And it's hardly the most conducive of bathroom facilities. Those of you that like a bit of privacy to read in will find that an open commode surrounded by U.S. Marshals and behind bars, because you must go into the cell to use it, is hardly the place to enjoy an early morning constitutional. And so the defendants, at the risk of their alimentary systems, with rare exceptions, Jerry Rubin was the exception, in fact, refused to use the cell room bathroom during the trial. Jerry used it for political purposes. He would go in the morning with a look of extreme distress, slam the door so loud that it would shock the court reporter into dropping a stitch occasionally. And then you would wait for this monumental flush. And sure enough, it was like waiting for the other shoe to drop. The whole courtroom, with bated breath, would wait for the flush, the clang of the cell door, and then the opening of the door into the courtroom, when Jerry, with a pleasant look on his face, would then appear before us and resume his rightful place at the counsel table. Now, to get a little serious about the trial, because it is a serious trial and was a serious trial. First, I think you have to understand it's not the most serious trial in American history by any matter of means. The penalties are not more serious than many others that people face around the United States. Bobby Seale faces the death penalty in Connecticut. The Panthers in New York face a minimum of 72 years and a maximum of 120 if convicted. There's a man named Lee Otis Johnson, former SNCC worker in Houston, Texas, that is serving 30 years for the alleged possession of two joints in that city. There's John Sinclair in Michigan, for much the same charge, is facing 10 years, has been convicted and is serving 10 years. And there are others all around the country who are facing the most serious felony penalties for their political views. The conspiracy defendants, seven of them, were really quite lucky in many respects. They're all out on bond, including the lawyers. And they're out on bond, all of us, because we're white and because the trial attracted some money. No other reason. We have absolutely no right to be out on bond. I have moments of intense shame about the fact that as a white man, I should be out on $15,000 bond with the money raised easily for it by good people like yourselves. And there are men sitting in Cook County Jail, black and white men, who cannot raise $150 after more than 9 months in jail without a trial to pay a bond so that they could be out on the street. And yet I'm out, and John is out, and all the rest are out. And that isn't fair and isn't right. It's not fair and right that the Black Panthers sit in New York on a $100,000 bond. And because they're obstreperous about this indecency in court, that the judge will not permit them to go to trial after a year of sitting on this exorbitant bond that only stems from their political views, without signing a loyalty oath to the court, an oath of respect, something new. Courts now have to demand oaths of respect signed before a notary, so that if you violate it by telling the judge he is indecent and inhumane in giving you a bond that you cannot meet solely because you have certain political views about black liberation in America, and then holding you for perjury, I imagine, if you sign that statement and swallow your manhood so that you can get a trial, and then face an additional penalty because you have violated your oath of respect. They have to stand and never sign such an oath. And what's going to get them out of jail is going to be the angry response of people like yourselves, who are going to say at some point that this indecency cannot go on and that we have to do something about it. And I think now, when you say things like this, the response of authority is, are you advocating violence? Are you telling people that they must take to the streets, that they must destroy the jail, that they must kill and maim? And I think there's an easy answer to this. And I think it's one that responsible people should give. I think that if the government, any government, continues to perpetuate obscenities in the name of the law and continues to openly rape and violate the Constitution they're sworn to defend, and if they are given a reasonable time by conventional methods to respond to what is right, and if they continue to fail to respond, then I think sensitive and thinking people must think in terms of an acceleration and a change of tactic. And I think that to ignore this possibility is to do a tremendous disservice to everyone, to do exactly what Marie Antoinette is rumored to have said when they told her that the peasants had no bread. To respond with "let them eat cake" is an answer that is sure to change the tempo of their protest. And since what she said was, for all purposes, the response of the ruling class in 18th century France, the result was a violent and bloody revolution. Now, no sane person would stand before anybody and say he or she desires a violent and bloody revolution if there are alternatives. And I think we're in an age at this moment where there are alternatives. But I think that we have reached a period in time where these alternatives are beginning to vanish. But there is not yet an end to them. There is not yet an end of time. There is not yet a dropping of the curtain. There is time for society to respond to the legitimate grievances that cry out from one. But there is not yet an end to them. There is not yet an end of time. There is not yet a dropping of the curtain. There is time for society to respond to the legitimate grievances that cry out from one corner of this land to the other. We sit here today while Vietnamese, and Americans are dying in a war that's incomprehensible to anyone. We sit here today while babies die of malnutrition in Appalachia, while black men are being systematically hunted down and destroyed because they're interested in the liberation of a people whom we systematically destroyed and dehumanized for 400 years and still will not free from bondage. They'll have to take it away themselves. We see universities from one end of the country to the other treating students as if they were some form of germ life that was brought into the university to be nurtured and then emitted back into the culture as a machine-made product down the assembly line. We have a society in which women have, from its inception, been second and third class citizens. And we have the hunting down by the quick use of the narcotics laws of an entire generation because they do not choose to cut their hair short or to wear conventional clothing, or because they may indulge in the smoking of a weed that no sane man has ever been able to prove was anything more than a mild stimulant, and yet they face charges of immense proportions. These things go on in our name, day in and day out, in this country, around the world, whether it be Guatemala or now Laos, Vietnam, and throughout the states of our republic. And we have gone into an age, John describes it a little differently than I do, but we've gone into the age of that clenched fist. And that clenched fist is not an easy thing for myself, who's up there in that 50-year range that John so cavalierly talks about, to do. I'm bred of a middle-class generation. I'm an officer of the court. I have an education which I realize finally came to me over the backs of black men and poor men who made the wealth that created this country for other people. And I stand in front of you and other audiences, and I clench that fist and I raise it in the air, and I do it with a great amount of thought. It's not easy for me. It's not a natural gesture for me. It's a gesture I didn't use until I became an attorney in the Chicago conspiracy trial. But the gesture to me means that we must pass from protests to resistance. And resistance resistance has a very clearly defined meaning of its own. To resist illegitimate authority is a call which Dr. Spock made in another way a year or so ago. Dr. Spock joined in the signing and publication of a little pamphlet which was called A Call to Resist Illegitimate Authority. The word resist appears in that phrase, and the words illegitimate authority. I think we have now a duty, as Justice Douglas points out in his new books, points of rebellion. We have a duty to do more than merely protest illegitimate authority, whether it's waged abroad or here. We have a duty now to say to ourselves, we have protested. The government has seen protest after protest. Our universities have seen protest after protest. There apparently is not going to be an ear to listen to protest. Or if the ear is listening, it is an ear which is clogged, whose eustachian tubes will not permit passage from receptacle to brain. And listening is as hypocritical as speaking. Therefore, since protest is not listened to, we must turn to other forms. Now, those other forms may vary from place to place. There is absolutely nothing wrong in history or in law, for that matter, in the seizure of a university building, if the university has failed to listen to alternative means. This was argued in Dartmouth College a year and a half ago, when two professors were charged with sitting in with students in the seizure of the administration building when Dartmouth would not end the ROTC program after 7 years of unorganized and organized protests. And there would come a time, if there was no listening to the seizure of a building, when it could be argued that the building should be burnt down. Now, that's not to advocate at this time the burning of college buildings, but it is to say that there is a natural progression, a progression that we honor in this country if we put it in terms of 1776, but which we somehow say cannot occur in 1970. That we're different, that property cannot be destroyed now for a legitimate goal of social protest, but it was perfectly proper, honorable, to dump 342 bags of tea into Boston Harbor. I might add, when John Adams was informed that the bags had been dropped into Boston Harbor, he said, I would have as lief have seen 342 British carcasses floating in the harbor. These were our nonviolent forebears. In other words, the actions of history, what has happened in the past, cannot be lost in view. Because to say that our age is going to be an age where all problems will be resolved peacefully is to say a great hope. And I would subscribe to it if it can be done. But I don't think we can exclude, and I think we have to talk candidly and honestly about this, I don't think we can exclude the possibility that if these peaceful means fail, if there is no response of any significant sort to what we urge and say and plead, then I think that only a dishonest coward could say we stop here and we go no further. I think to say that would belie every tradition of this country and every tradition of humanity. I was surprised when Justice Douglas issued his little book. And I was more than surprised when I read the first two or three paragraphs. Because in Points of Rebellion, Justice Douglas says, today's establishment is the same as yesterday's George III. And if today's establishment, he goes on, does not respond any better than did George III to the legitimate demands and grievances of its citizens, then, he said, the only honorable course is revolution. That's why the Chicago Tribune now has urged editorially that Justice Douglas is senile and should retire. But what he says deserves attention, not only by you or me, who might be half persuaded that more action is needed, but by those in power in this country. They must begin to understand that there is a very real possibility, not of revolution. I don't think we're in a revolutionary stage yet, or I would have said revolution rather than resistance, but that there is a possibility of acceleration into that phase if there is not some reasonable, significant attempt to, one, understand what's happening, to sense the winds that blow on college campuses and elsewhere, and two, some approximation of promise to reality. We cannot afford benign neglect. Benign neglect, which is what the president's program is essentially throughout, is really a program of saying, leave it alone. Let it work it out itself. Let the government really sit on its haunches. And using glib phraseology and good makeup to appeal to the silent majority, those who only speak once every 4 years and whose sole patriotic gesture is pulling down a lever in a booth or dropping a ballot into a box, acts which apparently gird you with 4 years of self-righteousness so that you can spend the next quartet of years in silent contemplation of your expansive navel. It was very interesting on October 15th, and maybe some of you saw the president's remarks, when he was informed that millions of people around the country were going to join in a moratorium, a day of remembering that brown men and yellow men and black men and white men had died in a senseless, brutal war in Vietnam. And he said, I will not be moved to action by the protests of American citizens against the war in Vietnam. When Marie Antoinette said it, she paid heavily. In making that remark, he lost all claim to our respect. Because what he was saying was a simple truism. I do not have to listen to those from whom all power comes, this office which they have created and which they have given to me through the mechanisms of our electoral process, I can disregard their heartfelt message to me. And therefore, I will turn my back on their protest. That is a most dangerous remark to make, and it is a perversion of the responsibility of an elected official in this country. It is psychologically unwise, it is politically unwise, and as Marie Antoinette found, it can be downright dangerous. Now, the trial, in a way, was a microcosm in the courtroom, a poor forum at best for a political trial, but it was a microcosm of what we are today. On one side, you had what John aptly calls the future. The prosecutor took great delight in making us call Abby, Abby Hoffman, and not just Abby, or Jerry, Jerry Rubin, and not just Jerry. He objected to the diminutives in court, just as he objected to every laugh, every chuckle, every embrace, every sign of human warmth. And he kept reminding the jury that these were not infants or young boys, and periodically, he would tick off the ages and show that with one or two exceptions, everybody was in his 30s. And Dave Dellinger was in his 50s. He said, these are not boys or youths. These are grown, evil men. But the point is, they were young people. Dave Dellinger, as much as Tom Hayden. They were young people not because of any age situation. They were young people because they had a state of mind and they had a vision, not always clearly articulated, not always clearly understood, but they had a vision that this could be a better place than it was, that there was a possibility that if men and women worked hard enough, that poverty could be destroyed, that private property could be ended as a concept. That the Kerner Report was true, and that we were corroded and destroyed as a society by a racism that permeates us all. But that something could be done if only you could support young black men and young black women who were feeling, possibly for the first time in American history, that they had at last broken the shackles and that they were seeking power to control their own destinies and their own communities, and that through this power, which they had never had, they could bring about the most subtle of changes in American life, that of the resurging manhood of a people after generations and centuries of its attempted destruction by our white super race here on these shores. And that by supporting these men and these women and not dominating them and not leading them, but being willing to follow and to let a vanguard arise that could bring about this most subtle but important of changes, that perhaps the Kerner Report, a century hence, would no longer be required reading for every American. They felt these things and feel them now. They felt that they could do something to turn Americans against a war, this incomprehensible struggle in which next April 15th, we cowards will pour money into Washington to continue. They thought there was some way that that could be done in Chicago, or at least a road opened. These were the things that they went to Chicago for. These were the things they were tried for, not for criminal acts. There were none. John gave you the charges and the proofs. A dozen speeches, air out of the right rear tire of a police vehicle. He forgot one. Tom Hayden was accused of spitting at an officer, right on Michigan Boulevard. But these were the real things that frightened the people that decided to implement this prosecution. And it wasn't the Attorney General of the United States, Mr. Clark, who ordered this prosecution instigated. He specifically ordered it not to be instituted. And when the court found that that's what he wanted to testify about, the jury was not even permitted to know he had ever entered the building. The crime was thought, dreams, desires, hopes of a future, dimly viewed though it might be, that had hope and meaning. A world in which young people could see something to the panorama of their lives, something that would transcend just being another machine-made product off a university campus, that would give people something to believe in and to die for if necessary, but something to lift us out of the daily role that lies so frighteningly ahead, the reality they talk about, that they paint so vividly, and which results in a bland life where cows and bulls stand next to each other and flick the flies off each other's backs with their tails and change direction only when the wind does. That there was more to life than this. These were the things that had meaning for them, and whether you agree with all they did or anything they did really makes very little difference. Any thinking person must agree that to desire change from worse to better, to desire an end of slavery, to desire an end of poverty, to desire a sane world in which men do not murder each other in jungles in the name of some state god that no one quite understands and no one really worships but fears. They wanted these things, and that's why they were young, because the idea was young. The idea was fresh and new. The idea that there is a better thing to do than just to be born, to eat, to reproduce, and to die. That there was more to life than this. Unfortunately, those in power do not understand the depth and breadth of the bitterness and frustration that ride this land. They rise up frightened when they see a broken pane of glass in the morning, or even an unprofitable branch bank burning in Santa Barbara. They point their finger at the mangled bodies of young people found in the basement of a bombed-out house in Greenwich Village. Young people who had decided that in the absence of an ear, in the absence of a listening ear, they had to become kamikazes and blow themselves up while inartistically stuffing sticks of dynamite into a lead pipe. And instead of saying, my God, what have we wrought here? what has become of our society, that the best of our society must sit in basements and plan terroristic activities and destroy themselves in the process, instead of saying, what can we do? What have we done that has brought this to pass? We say they're criminals. They're mad. They should be hunted down and put away like mad dogs. If that's the response, then they leave no alternative to more basements and more successful bomb makers than in New York. It is my profound hope, and I can't tell you how deep and profound it is to me, that government finally breaks its slumber, that government finally listens to the winds of change. Judge Hoffman was yesterday. And he looked into tomorrow with utter and abject fear. At the end of the trial, I said to him, I have only compassion for you. And it was true. The bitterness, the hatred, the frustration all dropped away as I watch this old, old, dried up figure of a man so afraid to hear Judy Collins sing, Where Have All the Flowers Gone? So afraid to have Allen Ginsberg ask, when are we going to end destroying the best minds of our generation? So afraid because he did not receive the respect from Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman, which he thought all tradition and all the past gave to United States district judges. So afraid that Tom Hayden standing before him and saying in his response to a jail sentence, I think that what I will hate the most, Your Honor, is the inability to have a child, that he could only glibly answer, the Federal Prison Service does not supply such facilities. So afraid of seeing before him 8 unafraid men, 1 black and 7 white, that he had to split them apart. And he took the natural way out for white men. You drive the black man out of the scene by doing what you've done to him for so many generations and centuries, the blatant open denial of the same rights which Justice Taney denied when he decided the Dred Scott case 123 years before. So afraid of the future that he would reincarnate the past and do it in a courtroom on a day-to-day basis. When I suddenly understood that, when I knew what he was afraid of, then I wasn't afraid myself any longer, because he can no longer hold back the dawn than Canute could hold back the sea. He can no longer stop the social revolution that's in progress in this country than he can stop the beating of his heart. He is lost in yesterday and seeking to control tomorrow. The thing he doesn't understand, and the thing I hope that government stops not understanding, is that you control tomorrow. Not the Judge Hoffmans, not the Richard Nixons, not the Spiro Agnews or the John Mitchells. They're in the same bag he's in. They're trying to hold back an entire future. Now, the problem is there is a chance, a bare chance, they could succeed for a time. And that's the chance you have to obliterate. They have to hear from you. You have to decide your own course. You have to make up your own mind. You have to pledge yourself that you're part of this age of resistance. You've got to move yourselves. And it is not an easy thing to lay yourself open to arrest, to being brutalized by police and other people, to being bathed in your own blood, if that be necessary. But I think you have to seriously consider whether you can live as human beings with yourselves, whether you can give up that magic germ of manhood that doesn't always stay alive in all of us for very long, whether you're willing to give that up without a fight and a struggle, and even a dangerous one at that. I think the Chicago conspiracy, these eight brave men, and they were truly brave men in the deepest sense of the word, they stood up before illegitimate authority, and they said what you have to say every day of your life, thus far and no further, Judge Hoffman, and then leave a bracket, because you can substitute for Judge Hoffman anyone you please. And there are many apt substitutions. That's what they said in that courtroom. That's the lesson of Chicago. The 60s, we marched, we wrote letters, we picketed. In the 70s, we march to a different tune and with a different beat. In the 70s, we march with a clenched fist. And in the 70s, we do whatever is necessary, by whatever means are necessary, to bring about the change that struggles so desperately in the wings, to be born and to grow among us. Thank you.